Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Great Dane Taylors, Incorporated versus the estate of Garland Frederick Wells, deceased, and others from Harris County. Churchill Forge, Incorporated versus Joanne Hamilton Brown from Travis County. And N. Ray, American Homestar of Lancaster, an original mandamus proceeding. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude all three submissions before lunch. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk. Court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Great Dane versus Wells.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Schick will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bob Schick. I represent Great Dane Trailers petitioner. We're here today to ask this court to reverse the holding of the Court of Appeals in Harris County and affirm the trial court's decision that the plaintiff's claim of inadequate conspicuity of a trailer is preempted by Section 108 of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Act of 1966. This case arises out of an accident that occurred at about dusk on Highway 59 just north of Houston. The plaintiff's vehicle was following a truck-tractor-trailer combination with a flatbed on it, which jackknifed after striking another car. Upon the jackknife, the trailer blocked both lanes of Highway 59. Mrs. Wells' husband was driving a car that then struck the side of the trailer, resulting in his death.
Mr. Schick, the recent Supreme Court case Greer, does it affect this court's decision in the Alvarado case? Does it somehow undermine the reasoning of the Alvarado case? And if it does that make a difference to your argument today?
It does, absolutely, Your Honor. In the Alvarado case, as this court is aware, the court found that under Section 208, the seatbelt portion of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Act did not preempt a claim for a lap belt in the Alvarado case. And the court found that there was neither express nor implied preemption there. The U.S. Supreme Court subsequently, in the Gear case, has found that while there is no express preemption because of the savings clause in the Safety Act, there was implied preemption.
So you are no longer arguing express preemption. You've abandoned that position in light of the United States Supreme Court's decision.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
So the only thing we need to concern ourselves is implied preemption, and you're particularly looking at the obstacle version of it.
Precisely, Your Honor. It is only the obstacle portion of implied preemption that we are arguing before this court this time. Because of the subsequent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in Gear, we believe that the Alvarado decision is no longer controlling authority. We believe that the plaintiff's claim in this case is preempted under Section 108 for the same reasons and logic that this court used in its dissent in Alvarado and Judge Breyer used in the majority opinion in the Gear case.
Do you agree that in an obstacle implied preemption case, that it is a case-by-case determination looking at the specific facts alleged and the specific regulation or part of the statute at issue?
I do, Your Honor.
So in fact, we have to look at Section 108 on its own, and what you're suggesting is that we apply the analysis, but you're not suggesting that by virtue of the Supreme Court's decision in Geyer that it means as a matter of law that any claims in this case are preempted by 108.
Exactly, Your Honor. We believe that it's the logic that this court does have to look at Section 108. In other words, this may not be the vehicle by which this court wants to overrule, if it decides to overrule, its decision in Alvarado, because that was a Section 208 case. But the analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court used in Geyer must be applied in this case.
Well, the analysis that this court used in Alvarado is consistent with the analysis that the United States Supreme Court used. It's just that the starting point was different under 208, and that is looking at the intent. The United States Supreme Court looked at the intent behind the specific regulations from the Department of Transportation to determine that there was an intended option, period, to get consumers used to it. And this court looked at the overriding purpose of the statute, which was to further safety. So the analysis in Alvarado is not inconsistent with Geyer. It's that the starting point in the specific case was different. Isn't that correct?
That, I think, Your Honor, that's true in part.
Okay.
For example, in this particular case, I think mm-hmm. the starting point still has to be, as Geyer instructs, or Geyer instructs, taking a look at the stated purpose of Section 108, and that's why I have the handout in front of you.
My point is that we identified a stated purpose for 208. The Supreme Court identified a different stated purpose for 208.
Yes, Your Honor.
But after that, the analysis is comparable.
It is comparable, except for one thing.
Okay, so that's what I'm trying to get you to. Tell us what's different about the analysis.
I understand that. The difference is that Judge Breyer took a look at the entire history of 208, and it wasn't merely let's give time for us to see what the public wants to get used to, or whether an interlock is appropriate, or whether airbags are appropriate. Judge Breyer took a look at the entire history and what the Secretary of Transportation had decided. In this case, with respect to Section 108, we have the same kind of a history with respect to what the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA, was doing from 1980 all the way to 1987 and then beyond. In those first 7 year period, they were testing. They were trying to decide what is it that is going to make a difference for motorists to be able to see a trailer in nighttime from a distance. And that's where we disagree with some of the courts that have found there is no preemption under Section 108. Uniformity in the context of Section 108 is more important than it is anywhere else. Uniformity is important in Section 108 because what NHTSA was trying to do was to make sure that motorists at a glance would understand that that particular pattern meant there was a trailer up ahead of some sort.
Uniformity was important. How come? I thought they were spending years experimenting.
I'm sorry?
I thought they were in an experimental phase.
They were, Your Honor, during the period of time from 1980 to 1987.
Uniformity is an over... I mean, in 108. The one in Alvarado, 208. There was a specific governmental theory that we ought to let 1,000 flowers bloom and see which one gets the greatest public compliance. And so the Supreme Court emphasizes a strong federal policy against uniformity. Here you seem to want to borrow that, but then you say that the government was in a period of experimentation, but then you say that one single uniform way was the be-all and end-all.
Well,
was the highest goal.
That's correct, Your Honor. They were trying to experiment to determine what would be recognizable most quickly. We're talking about motorists who are traveling along at 70 miles an hour, and they have to quickly understand the signal. It's why all traffic signals that we have on the roadways, you know, there's a meaning for yellow, there's a meaning for brown, for blue,
and
for
other colors. But if they were trying different ones, what's wrong with a state setting a torque policy that forces some type of marking, and then you can see that the accidents there go down, and so that would inform the federal government?
Because, Your Honor, I believe that if a manufacturer took that experimental step, it did so at its peril. And the precise language of 5.1.3, which says, this is what you shall have on the side of your trailer, and if you add more, it may not impair the effectiveness of what we're requiring. Add that to the Geyer mandate, which I believe is a mandate, which suggests that these standards, while they may and are talked about as minimums, they are minimums with respect to the manufacturer only. They are not minimums with respect to state requirements. The state cannot require more, so that during the experimental period, Your Honor.
But the state can require more under common law, and isn't that the whole question we're here to decide?
Your Honor, I don't believe that under the analysis of Guyer that the Supreme Court agrees with that. I believe that the Supreme Court was saying in Guyer that a state may not require more than the minimum.
I thought it said that
by common law.
Well, Your Honor, I read it as under regulations and statutes, the savings clause takes out express preemption and a state can't do that by regulation. I read Guyer as suggesting that even under common law, the state cannot require more.
Just in Alvarado and Guyer, the National Consumer and Safety Groups have pushed the federal government very hard to have nationwide airbag standards, and that was expressly rejected. Is there an analogous situation here where somebody pushed very hard for more extensive markings and warnings, whatever these are, safety markings and warnings, and that was rejected with a finding by the federal government? That's a bad idea.
Well, there were amendments that were proposed after NHTSA put out its notice of proposed rulemaking, and NHTSA rejected those, and then the Federal Register said that the reason for the denial is the importance of maintaining a common image of rear conspicuity while ensuring the availability of appropriate cues to drivers following large trailers. The regulations that manufacturers were obliged to follow were absolute with respect to state requirements.
And how would the extra markings that the plaintiffs contend for tended to confuse the average motorist on the road? Help me with that.
Well, for example, Your Honor, the additional lighting might have, A, impaired the effectiveness of what was already required, which under 5.1.3 means that you wouldn't be in compliance. The other problem is that they may have been of colors and of markings. For example, they might have been yellow and black. Well, yellow and black is typically used on bridge abutments. And in hilly parts of the country where you've got roads going like this and bridge abutments or railroad crossings going like this, a motorist could be confused if it sees that up ahead, assuming that it's a dip and it's going to go underneath that railroad crossing, when in fact it's a trailer that some manufacturers decided they're going to experiment with and put yellow and black marking across the side of it.
What's in the record beyond the answer interrogatory about what the plaintiff contended ought to be added?
That's all that's in the record at this point, Your Honor.
Is this case distinguishable from Harris, or is it just contrary? Is Harris just contrary to your position?
Your Honor, Harris is contrary to our position. The Eighth Circuit recently decided that case, and we believe that the Harris opinion is wrong for these reasons. First, it is contrary to the Fifth Circuit's opinion in the Lady versus Neil Glazer Marine case.
In the which case?
Lady versus Neil Glazer Marine.
So you believe cases before 2000, or we could still live it?
For some analysis.
Even though, I mean, both of our writings in Alvarado seem to me are going to have to be reexamined. I mean, they're not worth much now, but you think Fifth Circuit cases from 8 years ago are?
No, Your Honor, the Lady versus Neil Glazer was decided post Geary.
Oh, it was?
Yes, sir. It was
the Lady didn't involve this particular statute.
No, Your Honor, it didn't.
But Harris did involve this particular statute.
That's right.
And wouldn't Harris there naturally be more applicable?
Yes, from the standpoint of examining the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Act, but the
and
analysis.
Well, but looking at its analysis, though, mm-hmm. and looking at the way you're reading Geary, or Geyer, however you pronounce it, isn't it true that to the extent that any common law standard that is imposed does not conflict with 108, then it is not inappropriate?
That's correct if it doesn't conflict. But in this case, it does conflict for the same reason that Justice Breyer found that the imposition of a requirement of airbags conflicted with 208. What he said was, we might want more, a lot more airbags and a lot sooner, and that's a great plaintiff's claim.
Isn't there a meaningful difference between the Alvarado and airbag situation under 208 and 108, in that under 208, wasn't there an option for manufacturers to choose one of three or so different options?
That's how most courts viewed it, Judge, before here. I agree with that. In fact, they referred to it as a safe harbor. You had these three options. Unlike 108, many of the 108 decisions went off on, this is unlike 208 because there was safe harbor. That's not what Justice Breyer found, though, in his majority opinion. He didn't focus on the fact that, or believe that they were options.
Well, let's go back to the, I think, the fundamental analysis. You agree that there must be a conflict with 108.
Yes.
I still don't understand, under your arguments, how the proposed standard conflicts with 108.
It conflicts because it means that if this plaintiff's claim is allowed to go forward, it deprives NHTSA of the ability in 1986, or when this trailer was manufactured, or for that matter from 80 to 1991, of doing the studies that it did.
So your opinion then is that regardless of what the extra stripping or whatever additional reflective devices, regardless of what they may have tried to do to the vehicle, it would have conflicted with the car.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I believe that today, or even at that time, if a manufacturer put additional striping or additional lights, it did so at its peril. In fact, in the Peters case, decided by the District Court of Indiana in 1996, the opinion points out that Great Dane, back at that time period, was all in favor of putting additional reflective tape on, but wanted to wait for NHTSA's rulemaking to decide what the right colors were and the right patterns were. And the reason, again, goes to uniformity. In the context of Section 108, uniformity is the equivalent of safety, because we're talking about the entire motoring public being able to understand at a glance what that signal in the distance means.
Mr. Schick, in what way is the Third Circuit's analysis in the Buzzard case different on the implied preemption issue from the Supreme Court's decision in Geyer?
A couple of things, I guess, Judge. First, the Buzzard opinion goes off on the safe harbor analysis with respect to 208. It says 108 is different from 208 because 208 provides these safe harbor alternatives for a manufacturer to follow. I read Geyer as suggesting that that has nothing to do with it. Instead, what's important to Justice Breyer in the majority opinion is that there were a number of things that a manufacturer could do, but a manufacturer could do more. There was no prohibition against a manufacturer adding seat belts faster.
Well, but there's no prohibition in this particular provision either that would stop a manufacturer from doing more, provided that it does not interfere with the required reflective material.
That's right. And Justice Breyer's bottom line, as I read it at least, Your Honor, is that the state can't require more, especially when looking at the history of what the governmental agency did reflects a very careful analysis, just as was true in the Lady versus Neil Glazer case, where the court looked at the fact that the Coast Guard had determined that no guard was required, but no guard should be forbidden either. You could have a propeller guard, or you might not. Harris then reads that as somewhat akin to Merrick, which I suggest is improper. That's not an appropriate reading under Geyer.
I understand Geyer holds that you can't create a standard of airbags when options is otherwise available in 208. But does Geyer, I guess that's how everybody else is pronouncing it, does Geyer prohibit a state from determining whether or not the option picked by the manufacturer met the standards of 208? In other words, 208 had certain standards designed to protect occupants from rollovers. If it was proven that the particular design picked by the manufacturer did not meet the federal standards for protection against rollover, does Geyer, it has nothing to do with airbags, it has to do with meeting the standards, does Geyer preempt a civil action or a failure of the option pick to meet the federal standards set out in 208?
I don't think so, Judge. I mean, I think that would be you just failed to comply with the standard. You didn't meet it. You have, if the airbag requirement is it must explode with such force and be at least 2x2, and yours is 1.5x1.5, then you didn't comply and you violated the standard.
So Geyer does not necessarily, if Alvarado, part of the reason Alvarado was that Alvarado was not interested in the particular option the manufacturer used, but only interested in whether that option met the standards 4, Design 208, then to that extent, Guyer does not affect the court's decision in Alvarado.
That's possible if you read Guyer, and I understand how you can read Alvarado as a rollover case, potentially, as opposed to a lack of additional passive restraint case. And in that sense, it's possible, but I think that the court's application of implied preemption principles in the Alvarado majority opinion is now incorrect in light of the opinion of the Supreme U.S. Supreme Court in Guyer.
Do you believe if we apply Harris, you lose?
Sure. I think that Harris is incorrect for a couple of reasons.
Let me ask you this, because I forgot to check. What's the cert history on Harris?
It hasn't run yet, Judge. It was just, I think the decision was issued in December, I want to say December the 12th, and no petition for cert is yet due.
Is there a petition for rehearing in the case?
No, Your Honor. I think that's not yet due either.
Is Lady versus Neil Glazer time having to play?
Judge, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer on that case.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. I'm sorry.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Brown will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Brown. I represent Sametrius Wells, who is the personal representative of the estate of her deceased husband, Garland Wells. And it probably goes without saying, our request before the court today is that the opinion of the lower court be affirmed. The lower court did go off exclusively on Alvarado, and there is an argument that Alvarado is now in opposition with Guyer. As I stated in my brief, I think that that's debatable for the precise reason that Justice Enoch raised. In Alvarado, the issue of compliance with 208 was never directly addressed. And so, since Guyer is a classic 208 case, where everyone stipulated compliance with 208, and it was literally the no airbag, airbag issue, Alvarado is a little bit substantively different. All of that, I think, is somewhat secondary to the issues before us.
If the accident had occurred today, we'd be in a whole different position, wouldn't we?
If the accident occurred today, yes, we would be in a whole different situation.
Because the Federal Highway Administration now has cut out all the options. You have to pick one or two, and that's it.
Well, the Federal Highway Administration regulates existing trailers.
No, but if this very trailer that was manufactured in 86, it was involved in an accident today,
it would be out of compliance, yes, sir.
It would be out of compliance. But
yes.
Assuming that it had been brought up to standard, and then you were contending, well, it ought to have something in addition to what the Federal Highway Administration says, you'd be preempted from making that argument.
There seems to be an indication that may be true, simply from the language, for example, in the Harris decision. The court there notes that when NHTSA finalized its result that was in the NHTSA 1993 rule and the Federal Highway Administration 1999 rule, okay, that there is some indication that there may be an intent on the part of both of those agencies to consider this supplemental amendment, which does call for the increased conspicuity scheme, that they may consider that to be more of a standardized
uniform.
Well,
the rule says you either do this or this. There's no option in it.
That's not necessarily true, because the text of the standard itself has not changed, and the text has always invited supplemental conspicuity, both in its introductory paragraph.
Well, I understand the Federal Highway Commission in 99 said you've got 2 years to either add reflective tape or reflective flexible.
Stuff. It's the array of reflective.
And said you've got to do one or the other.
Right.
And so that's kind of the end of the standard, isn't it? Now.
Well, but you have to do one or the other to meet the increased minimum.
Okay, what would have happened if this same truck were involved in an accident post the 99 rule within the 2-year window for compliance? Wasn't there some balancing by the agency on the cost versus lives that might be saved, and said we're going to give you a 2-year window to comply? Wouldn't that fall within Breyer's preemption analysis in Guyer?
I don't believe so, because none of that would change the fact that under 108, manufacturers have always been free to add additional reflective devices as they saw fit to make the trailer safer. And Guyer would not change that. In fact, Guyer goes out of its way to say, we want to preserve the fact.
But now we have a regulation that says it's got to be red and white. It can't be blue and white. It can't be yellow. And it's got to be certain positions, and you've got to either use that or that. Isn't that more like the options that were available in the Guyer opinion now that the law has changed, regulations have changed?
Arguably. But I believe that because NHTSA expressly reserved and maintained in that statute the language that allows additional materials to be added, I think that that's an issue still to be explored as to whether or not this minimum is now a maximum, because that's essentially what the argument. I mean, the argument Great Dane has been making all along has been that if strict uniformity is what's required, then frankly a minimum standard becomes a maximum standard because you can't vary from it. Now, whether or not that may be true in the future, now that they have redone the regulation, I would argue that that's an open issue, and I would lean against it because they maintain the language in the statute that's been considered so important by all the courts who have looked at it, that language which says you can add additional
materials. But even in the airbag cases, you could have added additional restraints, you could have added an airbag, but that was not persuasive to the Supreme Court. So the fact that you can have additional restraints doesn't mean that you're still not preempted. That when the commission says you here are three options, and if you comply with one of the three, you're okay, even though you could have added an airbag.
Except I believe the distinctive difference in Guyer, and this was gone, I mean, both the Supreme Court and if you look at the government's brief that they relied upon so extensively, that the seminal issue that they went off on was the idea that said we didn't just provide options. We literally rejected the idea that you choose one option exclusively. They looked at, considered, and rejected the idea of requiring airbags for all cars. In a sense, they decided
that's my question. Now the Federal Highway Administration looked at and rejected the idea that you have to put on the red and white reflective tape sooner than. It gave a 2-year window for some trailers and a 10-year window for others. And so it made the conscious decision not to make people come into compliance. It gave them a period of time. And so should we take that into consideration, what's happened afterwards, after this accident?
I don't believe so, because I believe that both of those actions support what we stand for today. For example, that 10-year window. If you will look at what happened there, NHTSA in 1993 says, here's the new standard for new vehicles. They put a paragraph in their final rule that literally said, even though we cannot control these existing trailers, the ones that have already been manufactured, we think any reasonable owner-operator would immediately put on additional conspicuity.
But then the Federal Highway Administration said, we don't necessarily agree with that. It's a lot more problematic on retrofitting because you're taking employees away from doing maintenance and the cost. They went through all of this analysis. And they finally said, you've got a 2-year window for certain trucks and a 10-year window for others. And so didn't they make a balancing decision at that point that you didn't have to be in compliance immediately? And if this truck had been on the road during that 2-year period, they could have said we were not required, and the agency specifically made a conscious decision not to require us to use the reflective.
They made a conscious decision to allow a shortened period for those trucks that had no conspicuity. In other words, they said, you've got 2 years. If you don't have any of this enhanced conspicuity on your trailers, we're going to give you 2 years to bring those into compliance.
Should we take those regulations into account in looking at the overall federal scheme?
I suppose they could be taken into account, but I don't think that they ever will change the fact that it remained before 1993 and before 1998 a minimum statute, where under the common law, I mean, you could take it into account as to whether or not compliance with the new regulatory minimum is an issue, but whether or not under the common law a plaintiff has a right to bring a case that says, because you have been free since time began with the statute in 1966 to exceed these minimums, you should have done so when technology made it
obvious. But you were free to exceed the minimums in the airbag cases. And I just disagree with you on that. My question specifically is, should we take into account the future regulations in trying to get an overall picture of what the federal scheme is, or are we foreclosed from looking only at what was in effect in 1990?
Well, Harris, for example, would say that you look at it as of the date the issue occurred, which would be 91 for the injury and 86 or 87 for the date of manufacture. I think this court could be free to take into account the subsequent developments with the Federal Highway Administration, although I really don't believe that they would in any way compromise the findings or the rulings in Harris or Buzzard in similar cases that would say there is no obstacle conflict preemption.
In Harris,
yes,
they raised the possibility that there might be preemption based on the specific facts of the plaintiff's claim in a case, that if you specifically, not just in general, calling for more safety markings, but specifically said there should be more markings that would be that would take away from the other markings on the trailer, that might be preempted. Where is this? And they said summary judgment in Harris is too early to tell whether it is or it isn't. Where is this case in comparison to Harris in that regard?
Well, where this case developed in comparison to Harris at the time summary judgment was granted is it was much further along in that we were just short of our trial setting when summary judgment was granted. The issue, there was never an issue raised in the summary judgment of specific preemption in terms of the scheme the plaintiffs are advancing with conflict. And the fact of the matter was the expert testimony that was produced by the plaintiffs favored the exact scheme that later became adopted as of 1993.
So it's your position that the record reflects that the additional safety reflecting information of devices that should be used do not conflict with the standards in the statute?
The record doesn't necessarily reflect that at this time, not the record on appeal for summary judgment purposes, because that was never reached, much like they found in Harris and Buzzard, where they said, let's send it back and see what happens. The fact of the matter is, yes, the record will reflect in this case that there will not be impairment because it was the exact same scheme, which was already generally known by 1987, that the plaintiffs were, that we were actually asking for and seeking. With the issue of the Lady versus Neil Glazer opinion, I know there's some idea that says, look, you have to choose between following Harris in the Eighth Circuit and Buzzard in the Third Circuit versus the Fifth Circuit with Lady versus Neil Glazer. There's a distinct difference. If I can read just from the final paragraph of the Lady decision, the court says there, we do not hold that simply because the Coast Guard has not acted on a safety matter that state action is precluded. Rather, where the Coast Guard has been presented with an issue, studied it, and affirmatively decided as a substantive matter that it was not appropriate to impose a requirement, that decision takes on the character of a regulation and the objective of national uniformity would mandate implied preemption. In other words, the Lady case is very much like the Guyler case in that they looked at the history, and what they found in that case with the Coast Guard was that they had literally put together a subcommittee commission that looked at this issue of propeller guards. And they didn't just not act. They literally sent it back a recommendation that said, we're afraid that if you add these propeller guards, it's going to make it worse. It's going to make the boats unsafe to operate above 15 miles per hour. It's going to add bulk to the bottom of this boat that could create more blunt injuries that would overcompensate for the reduction of the cutting injuries. So it was very much like Guyer, where the court looked and said, the legislative history shows that there was a true policy, an affirmative policy decision behind the failure to mandate action.
So our decision in Moore was wrong. Or it conflicts with Lady.
It does conflict with Lady.
Just about to
which I would certainly prefer Justice X. But yes, I do believe there is a conflict.
I mean, I think it's wrong. But
once again, the critical issue here is that there is something present both in Guyer and QOA and in Lady with this whole propeller guard issue that is not present in 108. In 108, NHTSA took a long time to make their decision, such that in 1990, Congress even lit a fire under them when they amended the Motor Carrier Safety Act and said, get us a decision on this. But during that whole time period, they were not saying, hey, people, hold off. Don't put things on your trailers. In fact, they were constantly, if you look in their comments that have been submitted, they were constantly going to the industry and saying, tell us what you found with your experience. Tell us what you found with yours. And even when they reached their new final standard of conspicuity, as Justice Owen has pointed out, They said, you got 10 years, those of you who already have non-compliant conspicuity schemes on your trailers, ones that don't match our new rule, we're going to give you 10 years to let those go before you come up to speed. Now, what I would say there is, if strict uniformity is so critical, as Great Dane would argue, why in the world would the Federal Highway Administration say, we're going to let non-compliant standards stay on
the trailers? But uniformity aside, again, there's been a judgment. Federal Register, they clearly talked about, well, we were weighing X number of lives per year versus the cost and the taking employees away from doing other things. We've decided that not 5 years, but 2 years is the best compliance time. So they specifically blessed, if you will, trailers like the one in this accident being on the road for another 2 years without these extra requirements. So how do we factor that in, that they specifically weighed safety versus cost and all of this and said, you've got another 2 years?
No, I would disagree with what they said there. What they said there, they did not bless non-compliant trailers. What they did bless were trailers where people had already voluntarily upgraded.
No, that's the 10-year. I'm talking about
with
the 2-year. The people that had nothing. They said, even if you have nothing, you've got 2 years to put something else on. Now, how do we factor that in? Well, they made a conscious decision to let these trailers stay on the road another 2 years without anything.
Because every changed safety regulation must allow a period for phase-in. You have to retool at the manufacturer's shop. You have to buy equipment, buy materials, train employees.
How is that different from the phase-in in the airbag case? Because at the time of the Alvarado case, we knew that airbags were going to be mandated under that specific rule. 108 said by the year such and such, you've got to have all airbags, but we're going to give you time to phase in airbags. And how is that different?
The Guyer phase-in was a whole different matter. The Guyer phase-in was not one of these phase-ins that says, look, you can't immediately say to people tomorrow, instead of walking on two legs, walk on your hands. You've got to give them time to learn, which was more what I think the Federal Highway Administration was doing, is saying, we're going to give you 2 years to get the standard on every one of your trailers. Guyer was different. Guyer, the secretary came back and said, I specifically want to gradually work these in because we're so afraid of a backlash among consumers similar to what we did with our ignition lockout. And so the secretary, as presented by the government in his amicus briefing, Guyer, the secretary said, let's gradually work these passive restraints in. In fact, let's work them in a variety or a mix.
But how is that different from the arguments that the consumers made to the Federal Highway Administration? They said, look, people are dying thousands, hundreds a year, every year. We want you to make this retrofitting effective immediately. And they specifically rejected that argument. They said, no, that's too severe on the industry. We're going to give them 2 years. And other people were saying they'll give us five. And they weighed all of that, and they came out with a 2-year grace period. Now, how do we factor all that in? That subsequent to this accident, the commission, the Federal Highway Administration, at least, said, you've got 2 years, and you can go. You don't have to retrofit until 2 years. They're phasing in the requirement.
How you factor into this decision is a hard question. I'm not sure I understand how that would affect the decision in this case in any way. Nothing about that 2-year phase-in should affect the existing, pre-existing, and continuing existing common law exposure for failing to, despite the change in the minimum, for failing to do more than the minimum required.
But how's that different from an airbag? They could have. It was a minimum standard, just like this is a minimum standard under the statute, and they could have done more. People did more. Yet the Supreme Court said, you don't have to do more, and the common law can't make you do more.
Actually, the Supreme Court said specifically and expressly in Guyer that 208, with regard to this issue, is not a minimum standard.
But the statute says it is. And they said, when we say minimum, we don't. That doesn't mean minimum standard.
Well, but what the court said in Guyer is, they said, look, although generally these federal motor vehicle safety regs are minimum standards, by definition they are, 208 was no longer a minimum specifically for the reasons they talked about, where the secretary had come in and said, I don't want all airbags on all cars. Therefore, any common law case that says every car ought to have an airbag is in direct conflict with my express will. Guyer says on three or four occasions in that majority opinion, they go off on the issue that says the secretary expressly considered and rejected the idea of requiring airbags.
And how is that different here from the Federal Highway Administration specifically considering, do we make these people retrofit with tape and say, no, we're going to give them 2 years in some cases and 10 years in others? Now, how is that balancing any different than what went on in Guyer?
Well, it's a balancing that was not necessarily made for a specific safety purpose, but was made because they are always required under the framework, under the guidelines they are given on the Basic Safety Act, that they are supposed to consider economic feasibility. And when they require new safety changes, whether it's anti-lock brakes, whether it's increased trailer conspicuity or any others,
or airbags,
you would always have to give a time for retooling to phase in. But the airbag phase-in was different. It stands out in the history, in the sense of Safety Act regulations, because it was not just this sort of commonplace, you've got to give them time to get up to compliance. It was a specified program whereby the Secretary said, if we move too fast, we will make autos less safe. States are less likely to require mandatory seatbelts. People are going to find ways to turn these off because they're going to be irritated. Therefore, we've got to move slow and we've got to move gradually. That stands alone among federal motor vehicle safety standards. There is no other standard that has a history as unique as Standard 208. That's probably why it's received more attention than any other.
Let me come at this as a different approach. Suppose that it's agreed that 108 is a minimum standard, and whatever that means is you should have at least this taping across the bottom of your trailer. Now let's suppose that the Transportation Department comes in and says 2 years from now, we want the taping not only across the bottom of the trailer, but we want a complete outline of all sides of the trailer 2 years from now. For all the reasons you say, it's a very expensive proposition to make them do it immediately and overnight. If there is an injury during this two-year period, could a plaintiff claim that the owner of the truck should have done more to make the trailer conspicuous, meaning they should have outlined all sides of that? And would that not be in conflict with the provisions that says we considered that, but we rejected it for this two-year period?
If the provisions actually said that, if there was something in those provisions that said we have considered before this time or at this time, we have made a decision that it would be wrong to require that now, we're going to do it 2 years in the future, then perhaps that argument for
implied... But
isn't
that implicit in what you said is that the agency is required to give a phase-in time?
I don't believe so, because I think that the type of phase-in we're looking at with the Federal Highway Administration between 98 and 2000, or between 99 and 2001, is a phase-in that is almost a matter-of-course phase-in. It's required because you've got trucks out on the highway, some under lease to other companies, and what the government said is, look, we can't start ticketing these people for not being in compliance with our minimum required standard, until we've given them enough time to get all the trailers back in and retooled. I don't think that is similar to what you've seen in Guyer and even in Neil Glaser, where the legislative history shows that they have looked at a safety advancement and not just said, well, we've got to give them time to get up to speed, but have said, we literally do not want this safety advancement at this time. There's never an expression like that in the Federal Highway Administration or in NHTSA's comments. What the Federal Highway Administration says is it's unreasonable or unfair to make it happen now. We've got to give them some time and fairness to come up to this minimum standard. But once again, none of that has ever changed the fact that if 108 is truly minimum standard, then Guyer says you've got to allow the state common law to continue to work.
But you're saying that when minimum standards are established,
yes,
the standard operating procedure is to give the industry some time to get up to standard.
Yes.
And what you're requesting us to do is to impose perhaps an elevated minimum standard with no time for compliance.
I don't believe so, Justice Abbott, because remember that basic product liability common law will give that protection. In other words, as a plaintiff, if this were some new advancement that had just come out, that there was no body of factual information like there would be on this trailer conspicuity, I would have to prove affirmatively that they had that it was technologically feasible, and I'm sure that this whole two-year issue would be raised. But remember that this two-year issue, this phase-in, is phasing into a new floor. In other words, they've raised the floor.
But the new floor, if I understood you correctly, the new floor is the standard that you are requesting in this case.
It turns out that in 1993, yes, the new floor that was adopted happens to be the same standard that we were arguing for and the same standard that was argued for in both Buzzard and in Harris.
And so when the government opposes this new floor, Great Dane would have a couple of years to adjust to it. But when you're requesting this court to impose it now kind of retroactively with no time to update the vehicles for it.
Well, it could be argued that that's what's at stake. What I believe I'm proposing is I'm proposing nothing more than what Guyer has always said should be allowed, that when you have a uniform standard, okay, that true floor, which I believe 108 is, that there is always going to be some tension between what the government's doing and what the common law can do. And the court says that is a compromise and is well worth the benefit of allowing juries to continue to act in state-made common law. I don't think it would be unfair if, as a factual matter, I could convince the finder of fact that it was technologically feasible to exceed that voluntary standard ahead of time. What they're doing now with this two-year phase-in type deal, and what they routinely do is simply say, if we as the government, from a regulatory standpoint, are going to establish a different floor, there, in fairness, we've got to give an opportunity for people to phase in. That should not in any way, I believe, impact the freedom of the common law to continue to work in the presence of a uniform standard.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Schick, how do you respond to the argument that your position renders 108 a ceiling rather than a floor?
In this way, I refer to Guyer and the dissent that this court now brought up and say the minimums. As at the beginning of the Safety Act, it says the standards in this act are to be considered minimums. Are minimums with respect to the manufacturer. They are not, however, minimums with respect to state action, either through the common law or through regulation. This court said in the dissent, Justice Owen in the dissent in Alvarado wrote that the standards are minimums with respect to the manufacturer. As to the state, they are absolute, and they are absolute. I think that as Justice Abbott's last question and Justice Enoch's last question to counsel point out, the problem here
is see that voluntary standard ahead of time. What they're doing now with this two-year phase-in type deal, and what they routinely do is simply say, if we as the government, from a regulatory standpoint, are going to establish a different floor, there, in fairness, we've got to give an opportunity for people to phase in. That should not in any way, I believe, impact the freedom of the common law to continue to work in the presence of a uniform standard.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Schick, how do you respond to the argument that your position renders 108 a ceiling rather than a floor?
In this way, I refer to Guyer and the dissent that this court now brought up and say the minimums. As at the beginning of the Safety Act, it says the standards in this act are to be considered minimums. Are minimums with respect to the manufacturer. They are not, however, minimums with respect to state action, either through the common law or through regulation. This court said in the dissent, or Justice Owen in the dissent in Alvarado wrote that the standards are minimums with respect to the manufacturer. As to the state, they are absolute, and they are absolute. I think that as Justice Abbott's last question and Justice Enoch's last question to counsel point out, the problem here is that asking for a common law remedy here and what the plaintiff's claims are here is to take us back in time and say even though the government was doing all this study to determine what the one proper and appropriate solution will be, you needed to do it back then. But that's not what the government, what the federal government said, and it was not what the federal government's conclusion was.
Let me just ask you procedurally here. The rule I've been talking about that the Federal Highway Administration promulgated is not Rule 108. It was Rule 393. I forgot what the number is. It's not 108.
That's right.
And you didn't really rely on the Federal Highway Administration order or their regulations.
No, and if I may, Judge, let me explain why. 393 comes out of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Regulations. Those don't apply to a manufacturer such as Great Dane. Those apply to owners, operators, people who've got these trailers out that are already on the street that have been for a long time. And this trailer was manufactured by Great Dane in 1986, and it left our possession. FMVSS 108 applies to us as a manufacturer. 393 and its subparts apply to the carriers, not to the manufacturers. But the Federal Highway Administration continued to comment through the years on what NHTSA was doing. And in fact, the Federal Register that we've mentioned in our brief and attached copies for the court on has references many times to the fact that the Federal Highway Administration is visiting with NHTSA to understand what its purpose was in doing this rulemaking. And its purpose cannot be made more clear. And if I may, just a couple of quick highlights. The reason for, NHTSA said, while the agency is proposing two specific configurations of conspicuity treatment, this is during the test period, Judge, it anticipates that the final rule would specify only one pattern and not allow alternative treatments. And then it gives the reason, and this I think is important. The principal reason for NHTSA's requirement of a red and white pattern was to make the reflective image on the side of a trailer recognizable to motorists. Since the side conspicuity treatment consists of a single line of material, a distinct color pattern, less ambiguous than solid white or yellow, was established so that motorists would learn to associate it with trailers. It was important to the Federal Highway Administration, who concurred with NHTSA, and it was important to NHTSA that they gathered this data during the time frame of 1980 through 1987. What is the, you know, can we enhance, can we limit accidents by enhancing conspicuity?
But you would agree that this is a weaker case than Guyer. I mean, where in Guyer there was an actual statement that we do not want you to go out and do this uniform enhancement. There's not that statement here. Now, Guyer was 5-4, and I believe it did say that implied preemption is not going to be favored. So you would agree that this is a weaker case than Guyer.
Judge, I would, except for one thing, and that is Justice Breyer's comment during the majority discussion, where he says, we would have liked more airbags, and people might have liked more airbags and sooner, but we, the state, cannot require it.
But you'd agree there was not a clear policy choice here as there was in Guyer.
No, I think that there is. By looking at, as Justice Owens pointed out, by looking at the entire history of the rulemaking, including post-rulemaking, post-1993 is when it actually came into effect for manufacturers under Section 108. And if you look at that and understand what the agency was looking at, how they studied it, how carefully they studied it, what was important to them, and it wasn't only cost and effectiveness, it was what are motorists going to be able to see and respond to quickly. That is.
But isn't that going to be able to be gleaned from almost any safety standard?
I'm sorry.
A desire for uniformity or that same sort of history that you've set forth here?
No, Judge, I don't think that it is such as it is in 108. I mean, that's why I make such a big point about raising uniformity to the equivalence here of safety, because it is different from airbags. It doesn't matter to me when I walk in my car whether I've got an airbag that blows up this big or much bigger. But it sure matters to me and to millions of others driving along the highway that we're able to recognize at a glance what that particular pattern is. And if the state of Texas, through a plaintiff's claim, requires my client to have put on blue and yellow reflective tape back in 1986, that's going to be confusing to motorists now in the year 2001, who we hope have gotten used to, or at least NHTSA hope, have gotten used to seeing red and white around the outline of trailers as meaning that's a trailer up ahead. It's not a billboard. It's not an emergency sign or vehicle of some sort. That is a trailer. I better slow down and be careful because I might hit it. It might be across the roadway.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
That concludes the argument, and the first clause will take a brief recess.
All rise.